For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host Red Sale, and this week we take a surprisingly emotional view of human history with Dr. Richard Firth Godby here. Sarah Stavell takes a wry look at the maxim that you should never criticise how other parents bring up their kids. And we meet perhaps the perfect candidate to narrate Mary Berry's autobiography. That's all coming up on today's Read On. Dr. Richard Firth Godby here is a world expert on human emotions, particularly disgust. In A Human History of Emotion, he explores how the way we feel has built the world we know. Here he is to tell us more. Dr. Richard Firth Godby here, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you for having me.
In the book, you set out to transmit some of your own enthusiasm for reframing history through an emotional context, and you argue that emotions are as much of a driver to the great events in history as political regimes and cataclysmic events.
Yes, history is a weird thing in that it was the modern history as we know it was started by some very positivist scientific Germans in the 19th century. And so it's always gone on through this, oh, it's all an action and a consequence. And you can almost do an equation as to how history works. And of course, things don't happen like that. People don't start wars because they sit with a logic table working out whether it's a good idea to get the next person's land or not. They do it because of emotional pressures, because someone's upset them. And I've always been of the argument that emotions are key to history. Without them, we don't know what's going on. You can't understand Shakespeare without emotions, for example, even though plenty of people have tried. It is these days quite well studied, but it's not as well studied and out in the open beyond the halls of academia as I think it should be. So my mission is to push it past those ivory towers and say to everybody, hey, there's a history of emotions out there and it's brilliant. Come and find out.
And whilst there are arguably as many emotions as we've got fingers and toes, it does kind of boil down to six basic emotions, doesn't it?
Some people think so. There is a debate. Science going back to the late 70s, particularly a brilliant psychologist called Paul Ekman, who did studies where he took photos of people pulling faces of different emotions and worked out that most people identify six: happiness, sadness, disgust, fear, sorrow, and surprise. So he just really tested it. He found a tribe in Papua New Guinea who hadn't come into contact with television and didn't know what I Love Lucy was, which everybody else he tested this on did. And they seemed to identify the same faces, which suggests that there are at least six basic emotions all humans share, or at least all humans pull a face for. That science, it hasn't aged well, because people have done it again since and had different things happen, had people put different faces in different categories or not understand things in these categories that we Westerners put things in. And so there's another side of the camp. There's actually all emotions are constructs. They're built by cultures. As you grow up, you're taught what to feel and how to feel. And for quite some time, these two camps have been at odds with each other. The one said, no, it's all evolved, it's all universal. And the other have said, no, it's all culture, it's all built. And where the science is now is that the answer is kind of they're both right. In the deep down inside, there are things we've evolved to keep us alive. Love that allows us to carry on having a human race, and things like fear that stops you from being eaten by that bear that you just found. You'll run away from it. Very good emotion is fear at times. But at the same time, how we interpret those things, how we're supposed to behave, all of the, if you like, the window dressing of it, all of the ceremony of emotions, that is cultural. And it's as important to the emotion as this basic feeling deep inside is. So, yeah, there are universals. But on top of that are things that are very, very cultural and very different in time and in place.
And you start the book by taking us on a bit of a whistle-stop tour of how human cultures have tried to understand their emotions, codify their emotions since the very beginning. You start with the ancient Greeks.
Yes, they're the first people that we have, well, they actually wrote about feelings. Not systematically, you have to go through them, the different books, particularly Plato, but he does talk about these are what I think feelings are. There are these feelings and they do that and they work in this particular way. And it's quite different to what psychologists say now. So they believe there are three parts of the soul. One of them was the stuff life is made of. So even vegetables have that. Humans have that. Animals have that. The next is the bit that reacts to things, the sensitive part, which you have in animals and plants. And then you have the bit that thinks. Only humans, I would assume gods to the ancient Greeks, have that. And it's that feeling bit, that sensitive bit, that's where feelings are, they thought. But they didn't differentiate feelings by feeling good and feeling bad. They differentiated them by their outcome. So if the outcome led to virtue, to you doing something virtuous, then it was a good pathé, a good emotion. So if you were frightened to go into battle, and that fear kept you sharp in battle and you won the battle, that's good, that fear. It's a good fear to have. In the same way, if you desired power and wealth and you were really horrible to a lot of people and not very virtuous at all, then that desire was bad. And that's kind of how the Greeks saw it, which is a way that we all saw it in the West for 1500 years or so after the Greeks. Like everything else, it all comes from the Greeks, Western culture. Yes, that's kind of as far as back as we can go without speculating on prehistoric art, which I didn't want to go there because there are people much cleverer than me looking at that and they're all not sure. So,
and of course, this is a very attractive way for a cultural regime to build a power base. If you can inspire people to be virtuous and to do things for the common good and not just to follow their whims, then of course you can control more people. Even if you're making somebody do something that they might find unpleasant to do.
Yes, creating what we in the history of emotions call emotional regimes, which is a way, it's that way, that top-down way you're supposed to behave in certain situations, can be used for good or it can be used for bad. It can be used to create ways you're supposed to be. So there are times in history when the way you're supposed to react to something, you learn from above. So for example, if you are in 17th century Europe, where you are convinced the end of the world is coming soon because everything's a bit strange, there's a whole continent being discovered and there's no Silk Road and there's lots of new diseases and everyone's at war and there's a different type of Christianity that really confuses you and they're at war and so the Antichrist must be here. To pin that fear and say, right, those women who are causing trouble, they're part of this, they are witches. You must find those revolting, horrible, disgusting women and sort of treat these women that way. Can lead to great, terrible, horrible things like tens of thousands of women being burnt at the stake for a crime that pretty much definitely didn't do. Or worse, you can have, and another example, it's not in the book, but it's another example, is the way that the Nazi Party demonized the Jewish people of Germany and beyond using films that compare them to vermin, which is a terrible way of using an emotional regime to make everybody think, well, those people are untouchable, we shouldn't go there. And even in America, where to create love of the country during the Cold War, they used moms because that was the most powerful force they could find. It's the most powerful force anyone could find, I suspect. And so they created this, kids should love their mothers and they should love the country in the same way, and sort of tied this love of the mother to the love of the country and create a country where it's all about loving the United States and loving the flag and everything's about passion for the country, which is still with us now in certain parts of America, as anyone who watches the news may see. Every little group has an emotional regime, a little way you're supposed to be, a little way you're supposed to behave when you feel things.
Yeah, and this, as you say, at its best can create a for the greater good.
Yes.
And we all go off and get vaccinated to save our NHS, but at worst, it others people and dehumanizes them. And I suppose, as you say, allows for the rise of the Nazi Party and the Holocaust, or for people to become slave traders and see other human beings as a commodity.
Yes, it can very much be used in that way. One of the most powerful emotions used to control people is disgust or revulsion or that kind of thing. And that's a powerful way to say that those humans over there aren't as good a human as you are, so you can treat them differently. If you go throughout history, you see that all too often, that the way atrocities happen is because the people at the receiving end are made out by usually some power at the top to be less than human in some way. But it can do good things. You know, there are times when what you would think of as a bad emotion, like shame, haji, a type of Japanese shame, eventually propelled Japan out of being, well, they were a little island. They didn't want anything to do with anyone in the world until the Americans turned up in the late 19th century with two big warships and said, we'd like to trade with you. And if you don't, we've got very big cannons. But it was the shame of that moment that's created arguably the current work ethic in Japan and made them one of the wealthiest nations in the world. And many of us have cars, and I have several guitars and things, all built in Japan because of this driving shame that they were left behind so long that still powers through them. So these sort of emotional regimes can do good, even if the feeling is what we would consider a bad one these days.
Now, emotional regimes don't stay static. No. And one of the ways that you examine how emotions have helped govern history is to look at how the words that we use to describe our emotions have changed in the 2,500 years since we started writing down our history.
Yeah.
And you mentioned disgust, and yep, that's a word you focus on. That word has changed.
Oh, yes, very much so. There have been subtle different kinds of disgust over the years. So in modern English, disgust is that thing that makes you feel nauseated and revolting and horrible. Go back just 100 years and look at the German word, which we translate as disgust to this day, Ekel. And that was the closer to the feeling you get when someone tries to tickle you. You know, you are back off and you don't necessarily want that. And then you've got things like there was a word abomination. And that was the one that was used a lot with witchcraft. And abomination is a biblical term. And it's particularly interesting because abomination was the word that was used when the Vulgate, the Latin Bible, was translated from Hebrew. And Hebrews had half a dozen different subtle words for revulsions. There is the revulsion you feel to an idolater and to rotting meat, and then another one you'd feel for people who used fake weights and measures to try and con you in the marketplace. Lots of little subtle yucks, if you like. And then along came Saint Jerome, and he turned them all into one word, abomination and abominable. But it was always a religious context. An abomination was always something that sinned. And then there's aversion, which is a kind of a bit like the German Ekel. It's just trying to avoid something unpleasant. And disgust really came to be when a bunch of taste theorists decided they needed an opposite of beautiful. And so they borrowed from taste. They borrowed from good taste and bad taste. If good taste is beautiful, then bad taste is distaste. There's this word that's been circulating for 100 years or so, disgust. It comes from Italian. We'll use that because that means really, really poor taste. That now becomes revolting and disgusting as we now know it, all thanks to art, as so many things are. You'd be amazed how much power art has in history. And it got linked to morals because the same philosophers were moral philosophers and started using the same language. So now I have people behave in a disgusting way thanks to those people talking about art and morals again. But yeah, that's a great example of an emotion that the words have changed, and kind of what it is has changed with it ever so slightly, even though, again, deep down inside, the yuck is always there.
And it's not just regimes that can harness the emotions of large groups of people. You also investigate how music and art and architecture can help frame people's emotions. And, well, tickle them, I suppose, in some ways.
Yeah, in particular, I mean, architecture, from a personal story, is I'm not particularly religious, but even I, whenever I walk into a big church, feel something. And that's because every part of that church is designed to make people feel something when you go in there. It's an overwhelming experience of power and awe, these things looking down at you in the shape of the building. But yes, objects can hold great emotional power. A colleague of mine, Sally Holloway, particularly focuses on emotional objects. And just from a love letter, which is kind of an obvious one of emotional power, through to a gift someone might have you, give you, or a family heirloom. And also not having things can have great power. So if you are denied those things which you desire, fancy baubles, nice silks and plates, it might drive you to, I don't know, discover America, which is something that happened when the Ottomans basically closed down the Silk Road when they invaded Constantinople and made it Istanbul in the 15th century, the Silk Road was, well, it wasn't closed down, but the taxes were very, very high. So they wanted another way to get their shiny things from the Indies. And so one sailed off the other direction and found America. Other people went around the bottom of Africa and realized you don't burst into flames when you go down there. After all, it's not that hot. And so, yeah, the desire for things or not things can have world-changing consequences.
Now, we heard you looking over your shoulder a little bit earlier in the interview to your guitars. And yeah. As a struggling bassist myself, who stood in many gigs, there are bass notes in music that just seem to light up something in your soul when you hear it. And it's certainly something that anybody who's stepped into a cathedral with a large organ will have heard. There is something that seems to connect you to a greater spirituality about music.
Yeah, music is very powerful. It's a well-studied but still not brilliantly understood area of emotions and emotion history in particular. One area that if I ever do a sequel, I want to talk about is what was known as the devil's chord, which is a diminished chord, which every single interval between notes in that is dissonant, so it sounds wrong. And it creates this feeling of tension in people when you play it. And why it creates this feeling of tension, we don't know. It's just notes. Surely it shouldn't. But yeah, as a guitarist and bass player myself, there's nothing like a low B on a Warwick five-string bass. I've got to say, that is a very spiritual moment when you get to hit that low note and shake the floor. So why that is, who knows, but it's always been the case, yeah.
Now, you finished the book with a look into the future.
Yeah.
And how we may or may not be able to program artificial intelligence both to interpret our emotion and maybe display emotions themselves. And this is a very tricky Blade Runner-esque area of artificial intelligence and a great challenge for humans going forward.
Yes, it is. There are two topics really at hand. The one is, how do we get the machines to recognize our emotions? There are lots of people working on this in the millions. I was speaking to someone the other day who's trying to create a wonderful object that you would wear if you were, say, on the spectrum and you can't quite read people's emotions, and it will vibrate in different ways as it reads their voice to tell you what their emotion they're displaying is, so that you can better communicate, which is a wonderful thing. The problem is, that's not quite how emotions work. You need context. So you need to know how they were using that tone of voice or the situation they were in, you know, and who they are and what culture they're from. There are cultures that we in the UK would think people are screaming at each other in anger, but actually they're just having a polite conversation over a glass of beer. It's just how they relate to each other. And so that technology, I think it's doable, but the amount of data they have to collect to properly understand the emotions is massive. And there's a little bit of me that's worried that if we break down all barriers between cultures when it comes to understanding each other's emotions, that will lead to more and bloodier wars than anything else in history. But that fear aside, we can at the moment say, oh, sorry, I didn't understand. When we can understand, I don't know what will happen. But on the other side, there's, what about machines that display emotions? Will we know when it's a fake emotion, or will we know when the machine is actually feeling an emotion? Do we know when other humans are feeling emotions? How can we tell? They look like they are, just like the robots are. And we're actually already at the moment now where there are some robot pets that are sent to people to review, that they display their feelings, these pets, in such a lifelike manner that the reviewers refuse to switch them off to send them back, because it feels like they're killing them. Yeah, it's an interesting time. I think the next 20, 30 years when it comes to AI and artificial emotions are going to be, curious, to say the least. It may create a global regime that comes from our technology. Again, interesting future coming.
As we can hear from your voice, fun, excitement, and just passion for your subject, the emotions that come through, and even more so in your narration of the audiobook.
You could take pictures of a range of facial expressions and ask a group of people to sort them into a disgust pile and an anger pile.
You might be surprised to find the gape face in the anger pile, along with expressions of surprise, anger, fear, and confusion. If that happened, you might become convinced that emotions are culturally constructed. The question is, which of these methods is right? Is it nurture or nature? Well, as so often is the case when it comes to similar one way or the other questions, the answer is probably yes.
Dr. Richard Firth Godber here, narrating his book, A Human History of Emotion.
Were you determined that you should narrate the audiobook yourself?
I wanted to. They made me audition, which was fun. You've got to audition for your own audiobook. I'm like, okay. Well, you know, I'll be cheaper than the other guy because that won't cost you anything. But yeah, I kind of wanted to because I knew how I wanted to say it and what I'd said. And I was worried somebody else might not quite get it and quite put the passion across in the right way. So yeah, I really wanted to do the audiobook myself if I could. One of the hardest things I've ever done, though. I'm glad I did it.
Well, it's a fantastic audiobook and certainly opened my mind to a different way of looking at and understanding history. Dr. Richard Firth Godber here, thank you so much for taking us further into A Human History of Emotion, and I hope you'll come back at the end of the show to share the books of your life.
It's been my pleasure, and of course I will.
And thanks to the generosity of Richard's publisher, Fourth Estate, the audiobook of A Human History of Emotion, How the Way We Feel Built the World We Know, is available from the RNIB Library. You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews, and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, we meet the talking book narrator who could be a contender for the Great British Bake Off. But first, Sarah Stavell is known for writing literary fiction and thriller novels, with the focus on female characters. Other Parents is her fifth novel, and examines small community life where the public forum of the Parent-Teacher Association has a disturbing ability to disrupt lives and overshadow what is hidden away at home. But that's not to say that there isn't plenty of humour within its pages. Sarah joined Hannah Taus down the line from her home in Northumberland.
Sarah Stavell, welcome to Read On.
Thank you.
So can you give us a quick synopsis of Other Parents?
Yes. It's a novel set in a small middle-class market town, and it's quite a gossipy town and people love a scandal. And the scandal is that one of the women who's been married to a man for many years and they've had three lovely children has left her husband and got together with another woman. So that is causing all sorts of problems in this town, which is full of prejudice. And so it just follows the lives of five women who were caught up in this scandal. So the two women at the heart of it, their daughter, the head teacher at the school, and then one of the other women who is very prejudiced and takes against these people.
As you say, the book is written from five points of view.
Yes.
Is there any particular reason why you chose only to portray female perspectives?
Yes, it's because essentially it is a novel about women. And I thought, why not? I don't trust myself to portray men as well as I portray women is another thing. So I do usually write mainly from female perspectives.
So Maya, the daughter of Rachel and, well, Erin, her partner, is 15 years old.
Yeah.
I've noticed that teenage characters often appear in your books.
They do.
Is there something about the way that adolescents view life that makes them good drivers of the plot?
Yes, I think there is. Also, I think, you know, often teenagers get a bad press just in life in general, which I think is quite unfair. So I like to put a young person's perspective in. And it's very normal for a 15-year-old to be less than happy that her mother has decided or appears to have just decided on a whim to become a lesbian. I think that is normal. That's going to cause her some issues. And I wanted to explore that. And I do like exploring, you know, it's too easy to blame teenagers. And I just think, well, let's actually look at the reasons behind some of this behaviour that we don't like very much.
There are some excruciatingly embarrassing moments.
There are.
When Maya comes across Rachel and Erin at one point. Did you find it difficult to write that, as I say, excruciatingly painful scene? where she walks in on them together.
No, I didn't find it difficult. Maybe I should have done, but no, I didn't. I just thought that that would be a reason for major conflict between Maya and her mother. And so that's why I wrote it. And no, I didn't find it difficult.
The denouement takes place at the Christmas school fair, which is filled with both comedy and tragedy.
Yeah.
I don't want to give any of the plot away, but it must have been quite difficult to get the right balance between those two things. How did you manage it?
It took a few writes, to be honest. I did write it once and then have to rewrite it. It was a difficult balancing act, but I just think because of the nature of the book, it is a light-hearted read that tackles serious issues. That ending also needed to be in the spirit of that. I didn't want a completely ridiculous, farcical ending, but I didn't want it to end on a note of sort of tragedy or anything like that. So it needed to combine those two things. And I just worked very hard to make sure that I did that.
The PTA plays a big role in the story and all of the machinations that go on so that people can get their own ways. And it's where all the prejudices come up, as you say. I know you've got two children of your own, and I wondered whether your experience of PTA meetings have inspired this book at all, unless that question will get you into trouble.
I don't think it will. No, my school does have a PTA and I'm not actually very involved with it. But no, I do like the PTA and I think they do fantastic work. It's just that sometimes when you're a mum who's also got a job and all that stuff, it can just be quite difficult to fit everything in, that's all. And yeah, I mean, sometimes they can be a bit forceful and you think, I wish you'd just go and get a job instead of doing all this. But no, it's fine. I do like the PTA. They do good works for the school, but sometimes they're just a bit gobby, I suppose.
One of the issues that you look at is the difficulty of raising children, particularly for your character, Laura,
yes,
who is the one who, in a sense, begins the whole process of discussing whether LGBTQ issues should be taught at the school. Mm-hmm. Have you spoken to other parents who have expressed just how difficult it is to raise children, especially in the age of TikTok and Instagram and everybody saying what a marvellous parent I am?
Yes, there can be some of that. I think, I mean, I've got lots of friends who are parents. And yes, that social media, TikTok, all of that stuff is a concern for most people. With Laura, parenting is hard, okay? And I don't think anyone finds it easy. And I just thought how much more difficult it would be if you're on your own and you've got no money and you've got no support. I just thought, God, that must just be extraordinarily difficult. And I wanted that perspective in there of someone who is having to actually tackle all of this that we're all tackling, but having to face it on their own without enough money.
And what she goes through is quite horrific in order to try and support her child, Max. Do you think that it's, I won't say what it is that she does, but do you think that parents are sometimes pushed to the extremes in order to make sure that they're providing the best sort of life for their child that they can in impossible circumstances?
I'm sure some people are. Yeah, I think there's a whole underworld that most of us don't really know about because it's sort of covered up by social workers and people like that who are working with these families and keeping them out of the public eye and keeping them away from the press. But I think those worlds certainly exist. And so I wanted to delve into that world a little bit, a little way.
One of your other characters is Jo, who's the head teacher at this school.
Yeah.
Did you talk to any head teachers to gain their perspective?
I didn't talk to head teachers. I spoke to teachers. I've got a few friends who are teachers, so I spoke to them. And then, I think there was a bit actually where I did consult with my son's head teacher. I said, what would happen in this particular situation? How would the school deal with it? And she did tell me. So that was useful.
Was your son mortified that you went and asked her, or has he forgiven you?
He loves it.
Now, the book is narrated by Elaine Claxton. Did you have anything to do with choosing her as the narrator?
No. So my editor at HQ said to me, this is who we're thinking of, and sent me some voice samples. And I just said, yeah, that sounds great. But that was fine. I imagine if I'd kicked up a fuss, they would have listened to me, but I had no issues with her, so it sounded great.
The school was still officially outstanding, and the empire ruled over for 25 years by the formidable Mrs. Pearson had not fallen. In fact, word had reached Jo that there were murmurs about her having made things even better. There was now more music, more outdoor learning, more pastoral care. Things were good, she acknowledged, slinging her bag over her shoulder, then locking her office and heading down the corridor to the staff room for the PTA meeting.
Elaine Claxton, narrating Other Parents, written by my guest Sarah Stavell.
Are you a fan of audiobooks?
My problem with audiobooks is I don't have brilliant listening skills, so I might listen to it and then 5 minutes later I'll think, oh, I've missed, I don't know what's just happened because, you know, I was stroking the dog or something and I've totally missed what just went on. So, but I'm better at reading than I am at listening.
And what do you like to read? What are your own personal tastes in books?
I read stuff that's very different to the stuff I write. I mainly read contemporary fiction. I like Anne Tyler, Margaret Atwood, you know, the big names in contemporary fiction I mostly read. There's an American author called Elizabeth Strout, who's one of my favourites. But I do read some crime. And my favourite author, who I always go to if I happen to be in a bit of a reading slump, is Leanne Moriarty. I mean, I guess I am quite similar to her in many ways, you know, because she does that light-hearted approach to serious issues. And I always enjoy her books.
You've been compared to her before. It's a lovely compliment to have.
A lovely compliment, yes, yeah.
I know that you've already started working on your next book. Can you tell us anything about it? And is there any mention of patisserie in it? Because I know that you're a keen baker.
Yeah, I think I have some cake-making scenes in it. Not patisserie so much, but there is some cake-making scenes, definitely. Yes, it's more of a family saga, this one. So there's a couple in their 70s, and all three of their adult children are coming home for Christmas, and they haven't had the whole family together for many years because their eldest son has lived in New Zealand for a long time. Actually, I've just changed that to Australia, but anyway. And it's all about how the mother is desperate to have a perfect family Christmas, and obviously that's not possible. So all the children come home with their own children, and all the grudges and the conflicts and the resentments from the past blow up. The titles always come last for me, and that's the final bit that I've got to come up with.
You will be on the publicity trail. It must be quite difficult, actually, going from I'm busy writing my new book and I'm talking about my old one.
Yeah, it is. And sometimes people ask me stuff about it and I'm like, oh God, I can't honestly remember. It's like, it's only 2 years since I finished it. I'm just like, oh God, I don't know.
How long does it usually take you to write a book?
I would usually allow a year. Other Parents only took about 6 months, but that's because I've just really enjoyed writing it. But I usually allow a year.
And how do you manage working around the kids?
Well, luckily they're at school now, so I just write while they're at school and that works. I have a long train journey to work, so I do some on the train and yeah, I manage to make it work. It's fine. Everything else fails. I mean, you know, my house is a mess and so it's just writing and the kids and everything else falls apart, really.
Those are the two important bits, though.
Well, yeah, that's how I see it.
Well, Sarah Stavell, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us on Read On. And I hope you will come back on the show when the next book is released.
Thanks very much, Hannah.
Other Parents, written by Sarah Stavell, is available in print, ebook, and audio wherever you buy your books. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we return to Richard Firth Godby here for the books of his life, as regular listeners will know, RNIB Connect Radio's London studio is based in the Talking Book Studios in Camden. So I'm lucky enough to meet the authors and narrators who create our wonderful Talking Books library. And while I'm not supposed to have favourites, my next guest, for reasons that will become apparent, is always a welcome visitor. Regina Regan, welcome to Read On.
Thank you very much, Red.
So I typed your name into the RNIB Talking Books Library and it came back with 85 titles. Can you remember your first book that you recorded for RNIB?
The first book I recorded was Sabrina the Teenage Witch, back when it was reel to reel and there was one producer for two studios simultaneously. So if you made a mistake, you had to wait until they could attend to your problem. So that was terrifying. So when we moved here to Camden, it was bliss.
You must have seen a few changes over the years,
then. I have. Yeah, I mean, I think the studio is just fantastic. People who listen will know, but the production values are just incredible. And I champion the RNIB and the Talking Books, and all my friends would tell you that her favorite place to work is the RNIB. Yes, she always says that. So, yeah, I guess I have seen changes, but all for the good, I think.
Is it less nerve-wracking now that you know it's digital recording, so people aren't having to physically cut tapes and stick them back together?
Well, that's sort of what I was referring to. When you're sitting there, when you make a mistake, you already are thinking, oh. And when you have to wait because, you know, there's only one producer, one engineer for two studios running at the same time, you know, every time you make a mistake, you think, that's another 32 seconds, that's another 42 seconds. So yes, it does. The fact that you can just, as we say, sort of fall back and pick up again so quickly, it minimizes the humiliation quotient. Still there, but minimized.
And you've recorded some fabulous titles, some real modern classics. The ones that always stick out for me are the Tales of the City books.
Oh, yes, I loved those. I was so genuinely thrilled. I mean, to get one, but then to be asked to do the sort of series was just wonderful. I hadn't read the books, but I'd seen the television sort of miniseries years before with Olympia Dukakis playing Mrs. Madrigal and Laura Linney. That was the first time I ever saw Laura Linney playing Marianne Singleton. So I have to admit, I did lift a bit from that, just from my memory, because they were so vivid and real, those creations, those characters. But no, I loved doing those.
For me, it was one of those wonderful discoveries. I lost my sight as far as being able to read was concerned after Baby Cakes, which I think was the third or fourth book.
Yes, I think it was. That's right.
So for me, you are the voice of Tales of the City, which is why I was so keen
to get
you in here.
Yeah. No, thank you. No, and, you know, I've done a number of series. One of the ones that I love, if I could just mention it, is Janet Ivanovich's Stephanie Plum series. They're wild caper novels, and they're in the first person. So she's written like 100 of them. I think I've done 5. But even though I know I'm not a 28-year-old bounty hunter from northern New Jersey, I feel like I'm now Stephanie. And the cast of characters in that, because there's a cartoony element to it. So even though I keep Stephanie's voice quite normal and sort of like my voice, but a bit younger, the characters around her are insane. So it's just fun to go a bit wild creating that world. And then, because I keep rather frightening amounts of notes and things, I can go back and say, oh, we've got Mrs. Carwatch, she's her neighbor. She's a low talker. So she's a low talker. She just talks really low and not, you know. So I just write little notes to myself. And then when I revisit characters and they return, I'm so happy.
Do you make notes that the low talker is somebody who you remember meeting in 1985 on a Brooklyn sidewalk? Or do the voices just come to you?
Sometimes I'd love to say, I pull them from real, you know, you hear actors say, I just sit in coffee shops and let voices drift over me. No, it's probably more likely that I might remember a role I did on stage a long time ago. But really, the way that I discover characters, if you like, if that doesn't sound too in quotes, is obviously the author gives us great clues, but sometimes they don't go into too much description about the character, or, you know, even where they're from. So I look at the language of the character. Do they speak very rapidly? Do they give a lot away? Or perhaps they're very terse and the sentences are very short. And you can glean a lot from the attitude of the character, which is why I like to prepare so well. So I kind of know, are they being themselves? Are they afraid of revealing something? Are they trying to conceal? Or are they being quite effusive? Maybe they're nervous, maybe they're flirting, you know. So all those kind of little subtle things, that's how I sort of find the voice. Somebody who only speaks in very short sentences, I probably would give quite a sort of hesitant, careful voice, rather than someone who just babbles on like me. When I started, I used to do things that I now just roll my eyes at myself, if that can be possible, and think, oh, I used to, I think, impose a voice on a character.
So we've mentioned the way that things have changed, and of course one of the things that has changed is that you can now carry the script of a book on an iPad. Do you still mark up paper copies, or do you mark them up electronically now?
I have to confess, I still use paper. It's not because I'm a Luddite, but I get migraines from lights, and I had sort of a couple of bad experiences with devices and using it all day long. I will have to switch because now that's the standard format, particularly commercially. They send out PDF files. So I have yet to tackle the markup on the iPad. But I completely mark up my manuscript, my A4.
And how did you come to the RNIB?
I wrote and said that this is my experience and came in, did an audition, and got Sabrina the Teenage Witch, and the rest is history. I always think that's one of the smartest things I did.
And bringing us right up to date, you were the narrator for Orange is the New Black, which of course is a huge hit on Netflix.
It is.
How did you find that? A woman 10 years after she committed a crime, living a perfectly normal life in the States, and gets sent to prison for over a year, and a hard women's prison at that.
Yeah, and the fact that I've only seen like one episode of the Netflix, but you might assume that the novel is fiction, but it's not. And it reads as fiction, but it's actually written by, you know, the woman who was incarcerated. It's her story. Yeah, no, it's quite a remarkable book. The reason I remember that one is there were 47 prisoners. So that's 47 prisoner voices. That doesn't count all the people in the legal world and the prison wardens and, you know, everyone else. But yeah, so that was challenging. But she wrote some amazing characters.
Again, I associate you with another author, Jodi Picoult, who always writes a good psychological thriller. And you seem to get very much into those when you're narrating them.
Well, the interesting thing is sometimes she writes from first person perspective. And that's just something else I thought I would mention. Obviously, if you're doing a first-person subjective, and if it's I throughout the whole book, if it's just one character, then there's not much of a shift. But with Jodi, she often will have maybe four or five characters in a story, all with their own point of view. And if it's first-person, that's even more challenging, because I have to suddenly become the Asperger boy and his brother and his mother in different chapters. And really remember, if it's first-person, remember that narration voice throughout the chapter. So I'll do strange things like put little pink dots, if it's the mother, on the top of each page, just to sort of, in case I get a bit lost in my thoughts, it's like, yep, I'm still the mother. Because point of view, I think, is fascinating. It's one of the reasons I have incredible admiration for people who say, oh, I just read the book once and I kind of wing it. I like to discover it with the readers. I think, oh, that would make me so nervous, because I want to know. I like the shifts in point of view. I think it tells a lot about attitude and tone. You know, are we in the serial killer's mind, even though it's third person? So it's third person subjective. Third person subjective can be quite first person. If you have someone, say, berating themselves, let's say they go to a meeting with their boss and they leave and they sit in the car, they might say, she didn't know how she could have said that. What was wrong with her? That's not neutral. That's what I love, figuring out who's telling this section of the story.
And I know my producer, Robert, remembers you for having recorded the Little House on the Prairie series as well, which is that presumably, you know, books that you must have read when...
I grew up on those.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, that must give you rather a nice warm feeling.
You know, I loved reading those because I remember, you know, reading about how they would... just the hardship that they went through. And yeah, I loved Laura Ingalls Wilder. That was thrilling. There were a lot of illustrations in the book, which made me sad because we lost those. And there were also little snippets of songs. So I was sort of making up folk songs. And I think I amused Robert somewhat, because let's just say singing is not my strong suit. So the idea that Regina was composing and singing was pretty funny.
Now, not all the series that you get are serious literature. You seem to have read quite a lot of Mills and Boon.
Have I? I have.
The Blaze Romances, I believe, which I know are very popular with RNIB library members. Are they fun to read?
They are. To be serious, the only problem that I ever have is if a book is well written, it's a joy to read. That sounds so obvious, but you can prepare it. But if, you know, sometimes there's a wonderful author, Shirley Jackson, who wrote the short story The Lottery, and I did The Haunting of Hill House. Sometimes her sentences, her descriptive sentences, would go on for 7 or 8 lines, but because they flowed so beautifully, they were easy to read. So as long as a book is well written, it's easy to read. The Mills and Boon they're fun. And some of the characters, I wouldn't say they're stock characters, but they're romantic characters that we want to identify with. So I might have my male, and I'll put a little heart next to him, my male heart voice. So he's like the heartthrob. He's the one that she has her heart's desire set on. Or I always think, take every book seriously. I would never send up a Mills and Boone because it's a romance novel. And there's something wonderful about it and something important about it to a lot of people. So I think they're very fun, and I hope that I managed to bring them to life with the joy and the sort of happy ending that they deserve.
And they're great escapism.
Yeah, exactly.
I think there's an awful lot of snobbery around, you know, what's literature and what's not. And the fact that Mills and Boone is as successful as it is means it reflects the fact that there are many, many thousands of people who are very happy reading them or having them read to them.
Exactly. So if I can bring that to life ever so slightly, then I've succeeded.
Do you ever squirm when they get a bit steamy?
I've been known to squirm. But you have to get over that, because if I wasn't comfortable reading one of the Blaise, Mills and Boone, I should say no. It's too late to be timid. If these people are falling into a passionate love affair and I'm going to hold back or make judgment on them worse, then I shouldn't be reading it.
Now, you are notorious for setting people's hearts racing whenever you come to the R&IB Talking Books studios.
Oh, I know what you're going to say. Baking.
Baking.
I have absolutely no illusions about my value. It is because I am a baker. I return places because I bake. I'm shameless.
You are not just a baker. You are a
No, but I'm teasing. But I mean, yes, no, I know. It's such a wonderful way to first ingratiate yourself with people, and then you become indispensable because they need your baked items.
Ever thought of going on to Bake Off?
Oh, no. No. No.
We'd all vote for you.
No. Oh, no. Oh, the standard now is so high. We're into patisserie land, or, you know, it's beyond. No. I have enough trouble preparing a book and starting. Every time I start a book, I'm so nervous. And at the end, I have what I call last page-itis, where I want to end the book properly. And I get tongue-tied and nervous, thinking, I have to sort of, I know how I want to do it. And, you know, so no. Can you imagine me in the tent? I would just be, I'd be on the floor weeping.
As I say, you're not just popular for your cakes.
Well, particularly the listeners are now thinking, oh, great, well, we don't even get the cakes. So, yeah, that's not very helpful.
Yeah, but, you know, one of our regular listeners, Chris Gray, actually chose a book narrated by you as his hidden gem in the library. It was Water for Elephants, which I believe you narrated with William Roberts.
Oh, that's right.
A great tale of running away to join the circus.
Mostly Bill Roberts, though, I have to say. I didn't contribute that much. It was really, that's a tribute to Bill, but thank you, Chris.
Do you enjoy doing collaborative books? I noticed you've done Cloud Atlas.
Oh, I love it. Sometimes with a multi-voice narration, ideally there might be more, even with some of the Jodi Picoult, ideally there might be more than one narrator, but it's very difficult to coordinate five different people with their schedules, with the production schedule. You know, it sounds easy, but it's not. I love collaborating. Although, actually, we don't really collaborate. Although I have emailed people, you know, sometimes just to say, what are you doing with that voice, or how far are we going with the accents, just so that we're all roughly in the same book.
Do you have a favourite book that you've narrated for R&IB?
One of them had to be a book I'd never read before, even though I'd seen the film, because it was quite a famous film, Rosemary's Baby by Ira Levin. And I absolutely loved it. Rosemary is quite controlled throughout the beginning. Well, she's quite excited in the beginning. You know, she starts out as a newly married, and they move into their dream apartment building, and everything's going well. And there's like perfect psychological horror, just a kind of drip, drip, drip of things going slightly askew, slightly wrong. Are they? Are they not? And I just absolutely loved doing it. And by the end, yes, I was going a little bit wild. But I thought, well, if you don't reach a crescendo with Rosemary, and not to give anything away, but let's just say satanic cult comes into it, then I think you're not doing a service to the book. So, yeah, I loved that one. And then another book that I loved, Fried Green Tomatoes at the Whistle Stop Cafe by Fanny Flagg. Now, I did this quite a number of years ago, but it's a good example of, it's perfectly written for an unabridged audio, because I just have the book here, if I could just quickly give an example. Every single chapter head, it will say, The Whistle Stop Cafe, Whistle Stop, Alabama, March 22nd, 1933. So we always know where we are. And then there's also a little newsletter written by one of the local people who's so funny. Sometimes without italics, without a change in print, there are visual clues that tell the reader we're moving into a different area here, or maybe a different character voice. We don't have that. So I love the fact that this book was set up to be clear, and we all know where we are in Alabama or Georgia. And yeah, I just loved it.
Regina Regan, thank you ever so much for giving up your time to come in.
It was my pleasure. Thank you very much, Red.
And I very much look forward to many more years of listening to your lovely voice and eating your wonderful cakes.
Fingers crossed on both counts.
I ran into Mr. Lassiter yesterday at the Ridgemont Mall, and he said the office is just falling apart with you gone. They don't get many good secretaries at Lassiter Fertilizers. Mom, that's sort of why I called. Yes, darling? I want you to call Mr. Lassiter and tell him I won't be in on Monday morning. Oh, Mary Ann, I'm not sure you should ask for an extension on your vacation. It's not an extension, Mom. Well, then why? I'm not coming home, Mom. Silence. Then, dimly in the distance, a television voice began to tell Mary Ann's father about the temporary relief of hemorrhoids. Finally, her mother spoke. Don't be silly, darling. Mom, I'm not being silly. I like it here. It feels like home already. Mary Ann, if there's a boy, there's no boy. I've thought about this for a long time. Oh, don't be ridiculous. You've been there for 5 days.
My guest, Regina Regan, reading Tales of the City by Armistead Maupin, which is TB14068. For a full list of titles narrated by Regina, search the RNIB Library website, rniblibrary.com, or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. Now it's back to Dr. Richard Firth Godby here for the books of his life.
Richard, was there a book that you read as a youngster that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Oh yes, there was. It has a massive influence on how I write and what I'm interested in. And it is Douglas Adams' The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which I regard as one of the greatest works of philosophy ever written, as well as a fantastic sci-fi book. When I read it, I never laughed so hard in my life, I never thought so hard in my life, and I could not work out how you come up with some of the language he comes up with, like the classic being, they floated in the air exactly like bricks don't. And you think, I know what he means. How do I know what he means? I just love the book to this day, and the sequels and the radio play. Maybe not the film so much, but that's another conversation. But and the TV series, of course. Yes, it had a huge influence on me. And I kind of hope that there's a spirit of that in my writing and my narration, because that's who I was channeling all the time. The great Douglas Adams.
Brilliant. And of course, they are a great series of audiobooks.
Yes, they are. Yes. And the original radio play, of course, which is, I still think, one of the greatest radio plays ever put together from the late 70s. When I went back and I'd read the books and I listened to the radio play, and there are things in there that aren't in the books that are just fantastic.
The story so far. In the beginning, the universe was created. This has made a lot of people very angry and been widely regarded as a bad move. Many races believe that it was created by some sort of god, though the Jatravartid people of Viltvodal 6 believe that the entire universe was in fact sneezed out of the nose of a being called the Great Green Arkel Seizure.
Gordon DeLieu, narrating The Restaurant at the End of the Universe, Book 2 in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by Douglas Adams, which, like the whole set, is available from the RNIB Library.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Well, there's actually one at the moment. I'm rereading it. I've actually got it in my hand right now because it's right next to my desk. And it's not a novel. It's by Kate Crawford. It's called The Atlas of AI. The thing that drew me to it is there's a chapter on emotions, which I could have written because we agree that closely. But the whole thing, and getting the idea of what artificial intelligence is doing now and how it's going to be used and what the realities of it are and what they're likely to be. And it talks about using it on Earth and using it for work and using it in space as well as emotions. It's a great book and it's really well written. And yeah, I'm on my second reading of that now in the evening. It's, yeah, I'd recommend it highly.
The commission found that the methods Hans had been taught were more like teaching children in elementary schools than animal training, and were worthy of scientific examination. But Strumpf and Funkst still had doubts. One finding in particular troubled them. When the questioner did not know the answer or was standing far away, Hans rarely gave the correct answer. This led Funkst and Strumpf to consider whether some sort of unintentional signal had been providing Hans with the answers.
Larissa Gallagher narrating The Atlas of AI by Kate Crawford, which is available commercially.
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the listeners?
It is by a friend of mine, actually, Kat Arney, who wrote a book called Rebel Cell, which actually, it's about the history of the study of cancer, which sounds really dark, but it's not. It's a very interesting, lively, sometimes funny, sometimes dark, as you'd expect, history. And I really would recommend it, because there are things about the study of cancer as a disease that I didn't know at all, that I now think I do. I probably don't, because she'll say, no, it's not quite that. But I had to simplify it. But it's well worth a read. I would recommend it for people who are interested in science, people who are interested in medicine, people who are just interested in a good read about the history of something and the science of something that's curious and different.
At the turn of the 20th century, scientists working for the newly founded Imperial Cancer Research Fund in London were busying themselves growing cancerous mouse cells in the laboratory in the hope of figuring out the secret of their prodigious multiplication. The researchers marvelled at the seemingly inexhaustible regenerative capacity of the cells in their care, with General Superintendent of Research Ernest Bashford noting in the charity's 1905 annual scientific report that, under artificial propagation, a mouse tumour has produced an amount of tissue sufficient to yield a giant mouse as large as a St. Bernard.
Dr. Kat Arney narrating her book Rebel Cell, Cancer, Evolution and the Science of Life, which is available commercially.
Well, Dr. Richard Firth, God be here, thank you so much for sharing your passion for reading with the listeners and for being a guest on the show today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today. But Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can always subscribe to the podcast by searching your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sail, and Robert Kirkwood is at Talking_Books. Thanks to producer Hannah, to all my guests, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.